Ladies and gents, welcome back to another Engineers podcast. Today we're joined by Tyler Miller, who's the Chief Technology and AI Officer at Katowiki, who are a marketplace for special objects, which are selected by their experts. We're going to talk a little bit more about Katowiki, probably at the start of the podcast, but there's some really, really interesting takeaways that I want to get away from this podcast and help share with the audience on structuring product experience and platform and understanding a little bit more about how tech debt works. But also, I think this is a real important focus on productivity that Tyler and I have spoken about and understanding ways of working, understanding how to get the best out of your teams. So we're joined by Tyler. He's got a really, really impressive background. He's going to give you a deep dive into that to start with. But a welcome to Tyler and looking forward to seeing what we've got today.
And thank you. And thank you for having me on.
Pleasure. Will we start with background? So, Tyler, you've got an impressive background. Let's talk a little bit about that and get to know Tyler, the engineer, or a little bit more about your career first before we talk about Katowiki, then productivity and teams.
Sure. One interesting fun fact is that while having made an entire career in software engineering, I actually do not have a computer science degree. My degree was in architectural engineering.
Okay.
From the University of Colorado. And then, what I did there within architectural engineering was specialized in a lot of highfalutin mathematics. And of course, yep. The way that you proved out your mathematics and that sort of thing at that time, was with ultimately coding, making applications that did the calculations. In this case, it's about light, radiative transfer. And that really, I had already, been very sort of savvy with computers and knew how to program a little bit, but that really, made that much more interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I very quickly went from an architectural engineer who knew how to code to a software engineer who maybe knew a little bit about architecture and construction technology. And actually my first few jobs were in the various forms of construction technology software, mainly doing 3D modeling applications. And in the early 2000s, I was an early engineer on SketchUp, which is a popular 3D modeling application. At the time, we were a quite small startup, very scrappy small startup, very focused on architects. And then over time, we did some integrations with other applications, one of which was Google Earth, which then led to the acquisition of SketchUp by Google. And that is where I started to do more engineering leadership and less individual contributor software engineering. And Google was a wonderful place for that, simply because of scale and talent density. Lots of folks to learn from, lots of materials to learn from. We were there for 6 years, in fact, at Google. And then SketchUp and me along with it was divested out to a company called Trimble, who is squarely in that construction technology space. And I went with that. So I was a director of engineering there for their architectural products division. Threw up about 2017. And then I made a very big change, which is moving to Europe. as VP of engineering for Prezi, and later chief technology officer for him. Up until 2020, where I made the interesting choice of moving both countries and companies during the middle of a global pandemic.
Good man.
That may tell you about the intelligence level that you're dealing with in talking to me, because obviously wasn't easy for anybody at that time. But adding job change and country change, you know, on top of that was difficult. As first chief product and technology officer for Katawiki, and now chief technology and AI officer for Katawiki, it's been quite a journey over the last almost 4 years, helping a scale up do just that, scale. And in fact, we'll talk about dealing with tech debt and that sort of thing later with that. So that's my career.
Love it. Last 3.5 years, helping shape technical strategy for Katawiki. Give us some more background than I've given Katawiki credit for. Fantastic business on Katawiki. And also help us understand maybe the last 3.5 years and we've been helping the organization with strategically, technology-wise.
Yeah. So indeed, Katawiki is a real exciting business. It's a online marketplace for special objects, where we have a large set of categories for these objects. In each of those categories, we employ experts, which enforce quality standards we have in each category. So they select the objects. You can't necessarily just sell your used socks on Katawiki, of course. So special objects, it's quite broad range for us. It varies across luxury items, which could be anything from a classic car to jewelry or watches, collectibles, stamps, coins, sports memorabilia, etc. Art. We do a lot of direct from artists objects, which is fantastic to give them a market, the sellers to be able to reach a broader audience. And then last, interiors, so lots of vintage interior objects and things like that. Really, really neat stuff. We were born as far back as 2008, but really in early 2012, we really kind of switched into a marketplace versus a place for collectors and their catalogs. The Katawiki name is the combination of catalogs and a wiki, right? Since 2012, it's been scaling as an auction marketplace for special goods. And one of the reasons we sell in auctions is that special objects tend to be rare, a little more scarce, hard to find, and a little bit hard to price too. Like, how do you price, for instance, art, right? Well, the price is in the eye of the beholder. So we provide various ways for you to buy, but a lot of it's based on auctions. So that's the company. I joined in 2020, and with, of course, the technical strategy as my main purview. And like many, many scale-ups, you go through a time in the beginning when you're a startup where you're in a race to find product market fit.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you're doing anything and everything as fast as you can in order to find that. And you're not necessarily thinking about longevity and will this scale to, not 50 objects bought, you know, on a day, but, you know, 500,000, you know, someday, right? So the, you know, there was a significant moment which most scale-ups hit at some point, and this predates me joining, where the ability to innovate on the platform really slows down because you've built up an amount of tech debt that, you know, puts you close to gimbal lock, if you will. You're doing so much business as usual, keeping the lights on work, that your bandwidth for innovation, you know, has shrunk. So I came in, you know, during the dig out from that moment. And, you know, that is not a, that is something I've seen in basically, there's a moment like that in every place that I've worked. And yeah, so indeed, we, you know, the first year and a half or so was really about how do you organize that dig out with all the dependencies that you have. And it's, of course, very situational, you know, to the technologies you have. How are you hosting it? How do they communicate from one part of the solution to another? What kind of people do you have? You know, stuff like that. So that was the first objective. And then once we had gotten to a baseline of reasonably efficient and flexible technology foundation, reasonably, that doesn't mean there was no tech debt or anything like that, or that you're not producing new tech debt. Then it, you know, we were able to switch back a much larger proportion of our time to innovating on the platform and making the experience, whether it's buyers or sellers on the platform, be as smooth, frictionless, and trustworthy as possible.
Objective one, and that 18-month period, that transition phase of mobilizing your team, understanding the technology and where you are, what you can currently do, and where do you need to get to? How challenging are those 18 months where you're really understanding like the impact of the decisions technology-wise that have been made and where you need to get to with the current understanding of where the business is and where it's going?
Yeah.
How tough is objective one really for a CTO?
Yeah, it's not easy, right? Because a lot of the decisions that you're going to make are one-way door decisions, okay? Which cloud provider are you going to work with? How much of the, you know, sort of pass layer technologies that they have are you going to adopt, and are you going to accept the lock-in that comes with that? What is your base architecture, you know, patterns, things like that? They're hard because they are one way door kind of decisions, but you have to make, in order to make real progress, you can't agonize an indecision about them, right? So you have to make your calls knowing that, yeah, there's probably going to be one or two of the many calls that you make like that, that, you know, you're going to look back years later and say, ah, wish I would have done something differently, right? And this actually plays into a notion that I really believe in, which is some amount of tech debt, no matter how careful you are, is inevitable. Nobody has perfect foresight, you know, and of course, the technologies that you put your foundations on are always changing and evolving. So they were pretty agonizing, I would say, but it was actually, I think the bigger challenge was, if you're a solution of any appreciable size, you have to just be very, very organized about the order and sequence of operations that you knock down these big inhibiting you know, pieces of tech data. Yeah. And I think that is where the leadership can come in and be real effective, because there are patterns to that. And so if you've experienced it before, you know, I think it can be quite useful to the team to bring that experience, help align them so that the right hand and the left hand, you know what each other are doing, and to quote Wayne Gretzky, that everybody's skating to where the puck's going to be.
He's an ice hockey fan.
Yeah. Yes.
It would be really good to understand the impact that you delivered for your team. You changed a couple of ways of working that I think have really worked for you in terms of sprint lengths, amongst other things. So it'd be really good to understand those changes, but also the mindset behind those changes and what you feel the impact was of those.
Yeah. So during this tech debt dig out, as I mentioned, almost all of the focus and capacity of the team was on that dig out. That's a very unnatural state. Either you don't have approval from your stakeholders to make that happen, you know, or B, it's a super risky approach. And Katowicki, to the credit of, you know, our CEO and a number of other executives, they knew that that was necessary at the time. And so there was a particular way of working during that time. But once we got to a foundational base, which was not necessarily, you know, great, but it was very, you know, it was solid and organized way of moving forward, we were very introspective about, okay, what are we going to do to our ways of working?
Yep.
In order to get the most out of our team, work sustainably. So in other words, let's not start building up a new mountain of tech debt. And be able to innovate as quickly as possible to the benefit of the end user, right? And so as we sat around and thought about it, you know, three kind of fundamental truths about the nature of software engineering, you know, came up. Number one was that it's a team sport. You know, we're long past the days where the lone wolf, you know, incredibly intelligent, you know, software engineer by himself or herself, you know, changes the world. And so it's very much team sport. And in fact, you know, Katowicki, the tech department, you know, even at this time, let's call it early 2022, you know, is 130-ish or so people. Okay. The other realization, number two on the realization, is that this is super obvious, but context switching is super damaging to productivity, creativity, which is very, very important in software engineering. Often people don't associate that as much, but I certainly do. And also quality, right? If you're writing code and you're constantly being interrupted and that sort of thing, yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier to end up with, you know, bugs or logic mistakes. And then number three was this thing that, hey, look, tech debt is inevitable to happen. So how do, you know, we need to manage it in clever ways that align with, you know, with the nature of people and the nature of software engineering overall. So that was kind of the problem statement in front of it. you know, and then it became, you know, solution space, right? What do you do to manage tech debt, manage context switching, and make sure that people are set up and enabled to work together as a team? The phase of the company and the nature of your technology probably changes to the solution, you know, the solution that you would come to in ways of working to deal with these things. So what we did, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say is the right thing for every, you know, company and technology to do. But it, I think it served us pretty well, you know, on these fronts. So what we, the number one part of the solution was recognizing that moving from working on your technological foundations, tech debt and tech foundations, is a very different kind of work and mentality than when you're working on implementing capabilities or features in your platform ultimately for the end user, right?
Yep.
And that switching that those mental modes is, you know, frequently is not helping anybody. Yet, I think anybody and everybody that's been around, even if they're not technical, if they've been around and part of tech-enabled businesses, recognize that if you don't invest in managing tech debt, you're going to end up, you know, in a you know, a situation where you can't innovate anymore. So step one was to secure an agreement and alignment with my fellow management team members of what is the level of investment that we put into managing the tech foundations, okay? And based on the state of your tech foundations, this could vary the percentage, right? For us, what we agreed on was 20% of our capacity, right? And much of my arguments to them was actually that level of investment will actually end up manifesting in us being able to develop product for the benefit of the user sustainably at a faster rate.
Yeah.
So for the very next initiative, it doesn't make it go faster. Right. But the next one and the next one and down the line, it does. And fortunately, you know, my colleagues on the management team understood that, you know. And so we had that agreement on the investment level, if you will, in that.
Yep.
Now it's up to me and my team to decide, OK, how are we going to spend that investment to the maximum effect, right? Considering that, hey, this is a team sport, and that context switching is not a great thing, right? So we thought about this a lot. And actually, I had had an experience earlier in my career where, you know, if you just tell your agile teams or your scrum teams or whatever methodologies you're using, okay, you got 20%. Go figure it out. One team will say, okay, we work in 2-week sprints and, you know, so therefore the last 2 days of every sprint, we're going to make maintenance days or something like that. And then some other team will say, nah, it's actually better if we, you know, spend that time as the first 2 days of each sprint for some reason. And a third team is going to say, you know what, we're going to intermingle on our backlog, you know, the kind of tech foundation work along with the, you know, product initiative work. Okay. And there may be valid reasons that all of them are saying that, but it violates the context switching rule.
Yep.
It also violates the team sport rule, because the nature of the tech foundation work actually is more horizontal and less vertical as in your agile teams. There is some of that, of course, right? But a lot of times it is transformations in your underlying tool chain, your build systems, your your development environments for DevEx type stuff. It can be swapping, you know, components, frameworks that, you know, that we use across many, many teams, right? And therefore, in the team sport notion, folks need to work together that aren't necessarily on the same Agile teams. In other words, guilds, right? Front end, back end, iOS, Android, stuff like that. So I said, okay, what can we do that addresses this notion of, okay, we don't want people context switching too much. And we, you know, want to create the opportunity for those people on very different teams to work together, you know, at the same time, not in, you know, asynchronous drop stuff over a wall sort of ways. And so what we said is, okay, it's 20% of our time. At Katawiki, most of our teams, we work in 2-week sprints. You know, so we say, okay, let's do two-week product sprints, and then do a 1-week tech foundation week, we call it. Okay.
Got you.
This is actually a concept that was a team at Prezi when I was there actually came up with. This is not an original idea or anything. It worked really well for them. We spread it to their immediate team of teams. It worked well there. And then eventually we did this all across Prezi, and it was very, very effective. So this concept I brought to Katawiki. And, you know, so that's what we do. We do two product sprints, 2 weeks each, and then a tech foundation week. And that calendar-wise aligns the people that need to work together on these things in calendar time so that they can. And it's a full week. It's not one or two days, right? Have you ever heard the joke about hackathons, 48-hour hackathons, spent 40 hours setting up my development environment? You know, you don't want that effect in the time that you're allocating to your tech foundation week.
Makes total sense. I knew you saw the benefits from this team structure. It's really interesting. I know we started the question around technical strategy for Katowiki and your objective one and how it's then translated over into, I think, your beliefs of how you should set up teams and your understanding of how teams can work really well together. But your three principles of team, no context switching, this one's important too. You know, that fifth week foundation, if you like, or the 1 week allows for that collaboration with no context switching. I think there's some really nice takeaways there for people when they're thinking about embarking on a long-term technical strategy, as in, how do you do it? How do you really do it? And that approach from Prezi seemed to have worked really well. What other things do you think worked well? I know we've spoken offline about observability, feedback loops, but just go more into your thought process around how you introduced those. They're not even metrics, observability, yes, but observability or metrics into some of that communication, feedback loops into communication, and how teams actually talk to one another.
Yeah. One of the things that we do is we do establish guilds think about them as aligned to our tech stacks, whether that's a client side tech stack, like a mobile application or a web front end or back end. And those guilds have a leader. Often we actually rotate this leader every year or two just to give people, you know, it's a role, not a job. A leadership role, if you will. and gives people a chance to grow. That's another advantage, you know, of working this way. You know, they're responsible for looking at their tech foundations and, you know, organizing their group to make really good decisions about what is the most efficacious things that we can do to make us more efficient or more flexible in the foundation. And of course, some of our principal engineers do, you know, have some oversight on this as well. And none of this is not instead of having some horizontal teams, platform team. We do, in fact, have a horizontal platform team with, you know, SRE, you know, site reliability folks on there and folks that concentrate on our developer environment, you know, where their customers are our vertical development teams. So it's not a either or. Yeah, those guilds are quite effective in making sure that that time, you know, during Tech Foundation Weeks is used to the best effect. So I think that's quite helpful. And then, of course, you can get quite specific into the, you know, technical architecture that you're after and such.
Yeah. Does that approach change at all? I know we've spoken about just here platform specific teams and product specific teams. Does the approach change at all within, let's say, different guilds? Yeah, and some of the team structure that we're talking about, does that change at all?
Yeah, it does. Quite often, when you're talking about product teams and or platform teams, the engineers on the team are reporting directly to an engineering manager for that team, right? Or a tech lead manager, depending on what titles you use, right? And so there's a hierarchical relationship and accountability there. Whereas guilds cut across those teams. And there's not a reporting structure that way. That's okay. You do have a guild leader for that. And like I said, we report it, but we rotate it. But it's not not a hierarchical thing. So it's a much more collaborative, a bit egalitarian thing. And what you find is that there's difference in the nature of the coaching necessary and the leadership by the guild leader necessary to make sure that the group converges on aligned priorities, and that you are being very careful about it not turning into everybody's got their sort of piece of the stack that they want to improve, and they got, if there's 10 people on that stack and that they're doing 10 different things, you know, instead being real clear about, okay, what is the most impact over, you know, effort that we can get, and let's make sure that we put a critical mass of people on there to drive that, you know, transformation or swap of a framework or, you know, whatever it is, you know, to completion as fast as possible rather than, you know, a small amount of progress on 10 different things. So that is a little tougher to manage, but it's fine within guilds.
Got you. Team structures is a really interesting thing that I think I see a lot of differences in, let's say, US software engineering compared to European software engineering. I know Spotify model with guilds was probably more coined by Spotify themselves, European business. But I think there are many different ways of working that US engineering teams have. I'd say there's way more varied approaches. Can you give us your experience of the real differences between the way in which the two technology functions you think operate?
Sure. I think there's a lot of concepts that are out there that are pretty universal and understood regardless yep. of continent. And often people do work that way just fine. And it's quite similar in both. But I think the capital environment in the US and that entrepreneurial,
we're talking money here.
Yes, that it's more available. It's a lower, it's a lower regulation environment, the way, obviously VC, work was just earlier there, perhaps, right? And that, led to a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. And one of the things I see in the U.S. is that when folks are part of it, everybody's part of it that joins that bit. That's a little bit different. Obviously societal values and labor laws and stuff are different, in different countries and stuff. And that does affect, some bits of the culture. In some ways it's positive, some ways it's not helpful if you're super supposedly agile startup, right? I think Europe is coming along pretty nicely on that, in terms of learning, adapting to those things. But the capital environment is quite different. Sort of the regulation environment, the agility pivots can be a little bit harder. And that, even that, I think varies quite significantly from country to country in Europe. May not be remotely the same in the UK as, say, here in the Netherlands versus, what it is in Portugal or Spain or France or something. So I think, you have to adapt to the environment you're in. I think the labor force in tech companies in Europe is much more multicultural. And I actually very much like that. I think a real mix of backgrounds and cultures in a team, I've observed, especially, at Katowiki, which is probably the best example that I've worked at in terms of folks. We have people from over 50 different nationalities just on our tech team. So more than that as a country. And I think when we all come from different backgrounds and things like that, we all give each other just a little bit more rope, right? When we're collaborating sure. with each other. And that's a really enjoyable environment.
Completely agree. Have you noticed any differences? I completely agree as well on how I think companies in the US are built versus how companies in Europe are built. They do have different values, and I didn't really think about it in terms of like societal differences or cultural differences, but now I've listened and digested to what you were saying, I really do see that. In the capital environment, you're right, is different. There is this attitude, especially in the US, to get money, execute faster, do it as a collective, whereas there's probably more of a founder's mindset. This is just my own opinion, but a founder's mindset and grow it that way. And there's a lesser equity pool for people that then come and join the business. And it's usually a little bit slower to grow than I think the US is just like.
Yeah, straight. I think there is, those differences you point out are pretty spot on. I think in the capital, it's much more common for everybody to have, some amount of equity. skin yeah. in the game, if you will, in being part of a startup. You know, and those, if you're an individual contributor or maybe younger in your career, the quantity of that may be quite small. But that can make a huge difference for you in your life, because those things, you know, if handled well, you know, if there's a good exit and that sort of thing, and you handle your money well, you know, can end up being life changing. You know, going through several acquisitions, you know, myself, you know, in the U.S., that, you know, indeed. And I was not a founder or anything in those, right? So it helps you work together as a true team, all pulling in the same direction. Meaning, I don't think anybody wants an environment where it feels like there's a separation between the management or the founders of something and the employees of it. Especially if it feels adversarial, or I want to get the most out of this, you know, company that I can possibly get for me, you know, I think, you know, of course, in the perfect situation, it feels like, hey, we're all building this great thing that we believe in together. Some of the structural things that are more normal in the U.S. can help with that. It's not an absolute, you know, that works and what's done over here doesn't, but it is, it's becoming more common, you know, for folks to have equity in the startups and scale-ups here, and folks understanding the value and the nature of that stuff is a big deal, I think, too. I have seen over here in Europe, you know, both at Prezi and a little bit at Katowicki, where we have programs for that, and it's not deeply understood the value of it. You know, so I think that becoming more kind of understood within these organizations, even taught, you know, by the CFO or his team or something like that, what these things mean can be important too.
Okay. Good. Do you notice any stark differences between like foundational level software engineering between US and Europe?
No, I don't think so. I think the information flow of the tools and techniques in software engineering is pretty prevalent these days. Because there are so many companies that are large tech companies based in the US, yes, indeed, some of those things, just quantity wise, emerge from there more than, say, companies here in Europe. But that, I don't think that that's any indication of a difference in, you know, talent here or there. It's more of an indication of length of being at this.
I agree with that.
So I have, you know, in my tenure here in Europe, I have just worked with some of the most amazingly talented folks from all over the world. So I think we've got that's not a difference or a make or break between companies there.
Yeah, density is incredible. Diversity is incredible. I'd have to agree there. So talk to us about remainder of this year at Katowicki before we wrap up. What's on the agenda for the business? Where will you be hiring? If you are going to be hiring, set the scene or close the scene for us, so to speak.
So, as with all businesses, we have great intentions of you know, growth, you know, and plans for that. Everybody has been facing a tough macroeconomic environment for the last almost 24 months now, and especially in Europe. We've been able to grow throughout that time. You know, maybe not as fast as you do in a normal environment, but still growing. So in that sense, we've been very fortunate, and we've worked real hard to achieve that. And so indeed, we are, going to be hiring. The quantities are maybe not as much as they were before, but one of the things that is a huge strategic objective for us in terms of growing the capabilities of our company, ultimately for the benefit of our end users, is we're setting up an additional tech hub in Lisbon. So we've started hiring there. For us, this is a play to simply cast a wider net for talent. We believe in the value. We work in a hybrid manner, 2 days in the office, 3 days from home. And we believe that value of that in-person collaboration, not often, but a couple of days a week, is still worth having hubs. So Amsterdam is our main hub to date for the tech department, but Lisbon is going to be our second. And so we are looking for folks across the gamut of the functions in tech. So product management, design, quality assurance, software engineering, obviously, engineering nice. Leadership, to build out a critical mass there. So we'd like to have at least a couple agile teams there and effective by the end of the year.
For people listening, you've obviously got a really good business based in Amsterdam already. A lot of our followership and subscribership are Netherlands based. But as you've heard it from Tyler, we're going to be building an office in Lisbon. I want to say a massive thanks, Tyler. I think delivering your experience, structure of the team, technical direction of Katowicki, and a little bit more about the business has been really great. It's been profound. It's been pretty good to understand how you've done things, how you've shaped things. And some really interesting points on the US and EU differences of company building and the mindset behind that. So extending a big thanks to you. Thanks for coming to join us.
Well, thank you for having me on. I very much enjoyed it.
Good. And for everyone listening, career sites below, where people can see in the descriptions, and you've got Tyler's LinkedIn page as well, so you can check his background out. If everyone else likes, shares, reposts, and subscribing is what keeps contributing to our community. Come and like this one. Come and do exactly the same as what you've all done before. And a big thanks from us, from everyone at Engineers. And Tyler, thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for watching this episode. Massively appreciate you listening and checking in with us. If you want to find out more about us and what we're doing, please check us out on social media. What we're trying to do at Engineers is build a community to drive knowledge sharing and experiences. On Twitter, we can be found at engineers.io. It's no underscore. We've also got a website, which is engineers.io. These links will all be posted in the description. Any feedback and comments are massively appreciated. We're always looking to improve on where we can. Thanks, guys.